Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grape Encounters Radio. It's David Wilson here for the next hour, and we have all kinds of really, really cool guests on the show this week. I am so tickled. I am especially tickled about the response that we got from last week's show. Oh, my gosh. It was just crazy. I couldn't believe how many Facebook friends we picked up. You know, just in the hour after the show, it was absolutely crazy. I was sitting there watching my computer go ding, ding, ding. So I guess we must have hit a chord with a lot of you guys out there because it certainly was interesting. And I personally thought it's the best show we ever did. We had a number of guests on. We started with Wes Hagen, who talked about how they created the Santa Rita Hills AVA and how he had to actually trespass on people's property and order to figure out where the boundaries of that AVA would be. And nobody really cared about being a part of it until the real estate values in the Santa Rita Hills shot up through the roof, and then everybody wanted to come to the party. Tough luck, I guess. And then an incredible interview with Keith Sarlos, who really talked about everything that happens behind the scenes when a family decides to give it all up and become an independent winemaking family. And it was just a great story. You can listen to it online at grapeencountersradio.com. And then we had our favorite girl, oh my gosh, Amanda Haygood, the traveling grape. The traveling grape girl came all the way out to California, to the Napa Valley, from North Carolina. She gave up her fame and fortune there to be where her heart called her to be. And we have her on the line because we didn't get a chance to talk about everything we wanted to talk about last week. And so we're so pleased to have our new best friend, Amanda Haygood, on the line. What are you doing, girl?
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's a beautiful weekend, isn't it? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, this is the weekend for the listeners to start their wine tasting. It's perfect.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it just doesn't get any better. And I think with all the rain that California's had, it's just going to be a fabulous season. And the weather's already turning out to be so beautiful. But man, we had so much fun with you last week. We were talking about bringing wine to restaurants and also how do you tip on the wine that you buy in a restaurant. And I don't know if you had any comments about it, Amanda, but I got into all kinds of scuffles with people over that interview. And I still contend that, you know what, we can make the rules, that's it. And we can decide how much you're going to tip, and that's it. We're in charge.
Now people are bringing wine into Denny's to have
a pancake. Oh, I know. I think Denny's is probably really excited about the little plug that we gave them, but... But yeah, definitely some people argued the point with me throughout the week that maybe I was wrong, or and then other people said right on that, you know, we could set the standards and that's that. So anyway, but if you want to hear that show, you can go back and find it in our archive. In the meantime, we're talking about wine tasting room etiquette today, right?
Yes, we are.
In addition to being the owner of the Traveling Grape, which arranges wine tasting travel experiences for people, you also work at the Von Strauss Winery.
That's correct.
And
we get all types of groups up here. We love having our guests up.
And that is fun most of the time, right? Working in the tasting room. And part of the time, it can be very challenging.
Yes. Very true.
Okay, so let's dive right into it. What do you got for us?
Well, you know, your tasting should definitely be fun. It should be lively, informative. You know, it's an opportunity for your guests to try new wines, make new friends. But there are some things that you want to keep in mind, too, when you're going into a tasting room. And the first thing is, you know, if you have an appointment, you want to try your best to be on time.
Now, well, let me ask you, at your tasting room, is it by appointment only or can I just wander in?
We are by appointment only, but people can definitely call us and ask and say, you know, hey, we're coming up. Can you accommodate us? And most times we can. A lot of places that are by appointment only, you give them a call the day of and see what they can fit in. If they can't, maybe they can fit you in the next day. A lot of times the appointment only wineries, it's not because they're being snobs or they think they're better than everyone else. It's strictly a license thing.
No, well, tell me about that. Why? Sure. I mean, what does that mean?
We just don't have a license to accept walk-in appointments.
Oh, I didn't know there was a difference.
Yes.
What percentage?
Laws are governing all types of things in wine country.
I know. It's so it's so complicated, isn't it?
They make it complicated. They
do. My gosh. Yeah. Anyway, okay, so that's tip number one. Tip number two.
You know, don't wear heavy perfumes. If you're a smoker, try not to smoke, especially right before going in. Remember, part of your wine experience is all about the aroma and the scent. So perfumes and smoking can really take away from that big part of tasting.
So now, have you ever had somebody that reeked of cigarettes or perfume? Have you ever asked them to leave? Or
no,
would you?
I
don't think you're that kind of girl.
I personally wouldn't. The nice thing is we have an outdoor patio, For us, we're not going to be stuck in a small, confined area. So hopefully that scent can waft away in the wind.
You know what you could do in those situations?
They could go outside and do it.
How about this? In those situations, perhaps you could have somebody who's posing as a wine taster come in, and they could stand next to the person, and they could and they could taste the wine, and they could go, you know, this has a certain. I think it's Marlboro, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Or Chanel number 5 or something
exactly.
like that.
Yeah. Crazy.
I'm getting a little hint of Winston here. And then look at the person with a glare.
And then stare them down with that
stare them down.
Stare.
Yeah, that's, you know what, that's horrible when people reek. I mean, I don't mind the perfume so much, but, you know, definitely tobacco smell will really screw up the tasting experience.
Yeah, it really can.
Okay, what else you got?
When you enter, there are two things you really need to do. First, you want to turn off your cell phone. If you need to talk, go outside.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, that's, no cell phone talk. Sorry.
That's rough, man. What if I want to call somebody and say, I'm over at this great tasting room, and I just got to tell you right now, write this down, and I give them the name of your top wines.
Well, that's what you're texting your Facebook and Twitter's for.
All right.
Okay. And make sure you pay attention to the vineyard dog.
Yeah, but, you know, it's pay attention, you know, pet the vineyard dog, but our friend who's going to be on later on, the Seattle Wine Gal, she has
I love what she said, yeah.
Did you read her blog on wine tasting etiquette? She says,
make sure after you pet the vineyard dog, you don't walk in and put your...
Don't put your hands in the crackers.
All over the crackers. I loved it. I think she did.
That is so funny. And she actually, about those crackers, made some point about, you know, don't make the crackers your lunch.
Yeah. I know. She has a great post on etiquette as well. It's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, and except you look at her blog and she's drinking, you know, straight from the bottle too, so she's got...
You gotta love the girl, I do.
She's got some very unusual rules, that's for sure.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but you, Miss Manners, have a different way of conducting yourself. And
yeah, a little Southern girl that I am.
You are so proper. And now, do you glare at people when they have the cell phone? Do you just look at them, or do you, you know, like a second grade teacher?
Well, you know, being a Southern, you want to be very discreet about it and just kind of smile and, hey, darling, you want to put that phone away and let's enjoy some of this wine.
Okay. Oh, I'd like to just hear you say that in person. That's fantastic. Okay, what else?
You want to make room at the tasting bar for others, David. You don't want to crowd the bar, especially if you're in a winery that's obviously busy. After you receive your tasting, back away a little bit. Enjoy it, savor it, and let somebody else sneak up to the bar and get their taste. There's nothing worse than fighting a crowd when you're trying to enjoy your tasting experience.
And especially the person that's up there that is so pretentious that, you know, they want to talk shop in great detail with the tasting room personnel.
Yes, and that's
and everybody else is going, just pour.
It's okay to talk to the tasting room personnel. You know, we love to make friends. We love to hear where you're from. We love to hear your stories. But don't drag it on for hours. If we're closed at 4:30, don't stay till 6 talking to us. We do this every day. We want to go home and enjoy our family. And don't use up all their time if the time's busy. Allow more everyone to get involved with the tasting room staff.
But maybe you're their only friend, Amanda. Okay, we got time for one more. One more. Give me the best one.
One more. Taste in suggested order. Always taste from white to red. And don't sit there and say, God, this is all the wine I get. And then grab the bottle and pour your own wine.
Oh, I think you would probably cut somebody's hand off for that.
I'd scream.
Just have a butcher knife there and just do it. Okay, that is some good advice. I think there's probably more, so we're going to have to get to that next week because we're running out of time for this segment. But if they want to know more about Amanda, don't go to the tasting room and try to have a long conversation because she's busy over there. But you can go to thetravelinggrape.com. Amanda's got a great blog, don't you?
I do. And
you're proud
again,
of that.
I don't mind getting to know my guests. I love having them up here.
But not when it's busy. That's the thing, that's what you're saying.
Right.
It's like,
right.
Don't dominate the room when there's a whole bunch of people there trying to enjoy those wines.
Well, a lot of people that are appointment only, you do have more time to speak and talk. But the ones that are walk-in, it's obviously busy. They've got a lot of crowds, the larger wineries. Just be careful about their time there.
There you go. So the conclusion is, if you want Amanda's time, make an appointment. We'll be right back with more Grape Encounters Radio in just a second. Hey, And we are back with more Grape Encounters. I'm your host, David Wilson. And you guys know that I love to spend a lot of time on the internet, especially Facebook, because there are so many people in the food and wine industry and also just aficionados and, you know, are just plain old wine drinkers and plain old food eaters that just congregate into big groups and on fan pages. And every once in a while, you'll come across somebody on Facebook that has such an enormous following, you just scratch your head and say, how did this person become so popular? And we have one of those Miss Populars on the line right now. She is Chef Shelley Maddox, and thanks for joining us on Grape Encounters Radio.
Thank you.
So what's the deal? Every time I go on somebody's Facebook page, you're there.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's totally crazy. You may be one of the most popular people I've never met. And you've got your personal page is full up, right?
Right, it is. You can only have maxed out at 5,000.
Yeah, and then you've got a fan page that's growing by leaps and bounds. You're trying to get everybody to move over there.
Exactly. I keep putting the word out that, you know, we're going to be shut down at 5,000 friends, and so to go over to the fan page, that way I get to interact with more people there.
Okay, so let's talk about your business. You have a catering company and you're a personal chef.
Right.
And the company is called Savoring Time.
Right.
And you are located in Southern California.
Yes.
And so what's the deal, Shelley? I mean, how did you get such an enormous following, especially as a personal chef? I could understand it if you were in a big restaurant that had 1,000 people coming in a day. But that's right. Not the case, right?
No, it's not. It started out to be just, you know, a regular page like everybody else has. And I started talking about cooking on it and started getting more and more ads, and then decided to do a Savoring Time fan page where every day I give a couple of tips or recipes out a day. And it exploded. And it's not hard tips. It's almost like old wives' tales tips that I learned from my grandmother or in an old cookbook or something like that. And somehow my name got passed around, and so I'm kind of known as the Martha Stewart of the pan page.
Wow.
So
except you've
crazy.
Not, I take it you've not been in jail, though.
No, never been in jail.
Okay, well, that's good. That's what sets you apart.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. So people are clamoring to get this advice. Now, on the personal page, you're maxed out at 5,000, so are you doing some housekeeping there and actually eliminating people?
I do have to admit that I've been doing housekeeping, but it's more, people don't realize that the more fan pages you subscribe to or groups that you subscribe to, that takes up all of your spaces for friends.
Yeah.
And so I've kind of had to go through some of that and just kind of delete that. That way I get to still have more people, you know, coming to my page and talking to me about cooking and things like that.
So let me talk specifically about some of the things that you're doing, because I found it really interesting, some of the services that you provide to people. And one of the things that you and I talked about also was some creative things pertaining to wine, which of course we're all about here, and blending wine, which I want to get to in just a couple of minutes. But you do some really interesting things. You'll like literally go into somebody's house.
Right,
and
exactly.
Completely reorganize their life, from their food to their wine to their kitchen cabinets, right?
Right.
Is that a big popular service?
It is. In fact, I got the idea when I was cooking for a client, and every time I would go into her pantry to find something, there were things dated back to 1992, and that is not an exaggeration. And so finally, one day I told her, I said, look, we have really got to do something with this, because I don't want to poison you. And, you know, if I grab a can and not and careful looking at the dates, something bad's going to happen. So it did. It took me and my coworker a day and a half to go through her pantry. And we not only pitched everything that was bad, but kind of alphabetized her pantry for her. And she loved it, and she kept telling all of her friends about it, and that's how that took off. So it wasn't something that I was set out to do with my company. It's just something that happened, and people loved.
Now, you're not throwing away the old wine, though, right?
Never throw away the old wine, unless it's been leaking and the cork is yucky. But, never throw away the old wine. That's the best.
So you will actually come in and you will cook for people. I imagine that's quite a luxury, first of all, to have a personal chef come in and just cook. But are you doing this all the time?
I do it once a week. I have 7 clients a week that I cook for. Wow. And it is not as much of a luxury as you think it is. I mean, it's pretty reasonable. I have some clients that definitely have no problem affording the service, and I have other clients that are just everyday people that they just don't cook or can't cook or don't have time to cook, and they need that service. And it basically ends up costing the same amount as eating out every night.
Wow. Then you're going to be coming over very soon to cook for the Grape Encounter staff. But I noticed that a lot of what you're doing is all about decadence and indulgence, because you create some pretty interesting experiences, I think, that even include massage.
Yes, we do while we're preparing you a 4-course meal, I have 2 massage therapists that come in and give you simultaneous
massages. Oh, get out of town.
It's unbelievable. It's the best anniversary gift one can give.
So I'm laying with my significant other on tables, and are we actually watching you cook while we're getting massage?
No, you're actually in a private area. That way you don't have to hear the noise and all that kind of stuff. And you do. You get an hour massage, and you come out to a wonderful meal waiting for you. And we call it delicious sensations.
That's just crazy. If you're just joining us, it's Chef Shelley Maddox on the line. And her company is Savoring Time. And she is by far and away one of the most popular people on Facebook, has a huge following. And if you want to be her friend, forget about it, because there's just no room. You're going to have to just keep asking and asking and asking. And when she clears out the dead weight, maybe you can get in there. But Shelley, I wanted to talk to you about wine blending, because you're one of the few people that I've ever talked to who is unafraid of actually doing some blending, after the wine's been bottled, taking actual bottles of wine and mixing it together, right?
Absolutely.
That is so cool. I encourage people to do that, and I think people are scared to death to do that.
And I think people just don't know that they can do that. I think that they think that once it's in the bottle and it's labeled, that that's the wine that you drink. So I really don't think people know that you can actually blend a wine yourself.
Well, I think when I first discovered it, it was one of those parties where somebody hadn't finished their wine and I dumped their wine into my glass, only to realize, of course, that they were drinking something different.
Right.
And I thought, that's not so bad.
It isn't. I like to take a good cab that I have served with a filet and add a little sweet Zinfandel to it, and then serve it later for my dessert if I'm having chocolate or raspberries or something like that.
Oh, that sounds terrific. Do you do any main course wine blending as well?
I like to make almost your own Cab Franc. Add some Merlot to the cab that you're drinking. It just gives you a different taste and aroma that you don't get from just a single variety.
Of course, the problem with it is that you may be only putting 20% of one thing in and 50% of another wine, and so what do you do with the leftover wine? Or do you just make sufficient amounts of this that you can liquidate all of the wine? I'm not sure what you do.
Well, first of all, I've never had the problem of having leftover wine.
Yeah. Wine doesn't sit around long,
A little trick that if you do have leftover wine from that, you can put it in ice trays and freeze them. And then when you're making soups or stews or something like that, you can add one of those little wine cubes in there, and it will add the wine to your to whatever you're cooking.
Okay, that's something I haven't heard before. So you take the wine and you pour it into your ice cube tray.
Right.
It freezes. Then I'm thinking you probably need to put it into some sort of a container so it doesn't suck up all the freezer taste, right?
Right. You can usually saran wrap that real well, and it'll be just fine.
Next wine question. What happens when you open a bottle of wine and the wine just isn't cutting it, and you don't want to drink it, but you really don't want to throw it away? What do we do with it? Because I'm of the opinion that if you pour bad wine into a recipe, it doesn't help.
Yeah, you should never use wine that you won't drink in a recipe. That's like the number one thing that you wouldn't want to do. It's a perfect opportunity to start blending. And that has happened to us many a times, that we've opened a bottle that we were really excited about, and it just wasn't what we thought it would be. And like I said, we open something else like a Merlot or a Zinfandel and start blending. And once it's been opened up, once you've started playing with it, you'll blend the perfect wine, and you think, oh my gosh, I was almost going to throw that
So you're actually saying that you could take a bad wine, a wine that you really couldn't drink a la carte, mm-hmm. and you can add something better to it, or just something complimentary to it, and it's going to improve that wine.
Yes, it definitely will.
Right. I would love to have some examples of that and try that. I'm a little skeptical about pouring my good wine into bad wine. That's like throwing good money after bad, I think. But I would love for actually our listeners to send in some of their blending ideas and, you know, some specific wines that they blended together and in what percentages. I think it'd be really fun to see what people are doing out there.
Exactly. It would be. And I know I was able to go down to a friend of mine who is running his own winery, and it's called Orange County Custom Wines. And he is doing that at his wine bar. He's actually got barrels of wine that you can go through and taste.
And you
on
can,
their own.
And you can actually blend them right there on the premises.
You actually get to blend them right
so
there
cool.
at the tasting room. It's phenomenal because it's fresh out of the barrel. So obviously that has a different taste than when it's been bottled. And just going around with the spout and pouring a little bit of this and a little bit of that in, it's quite an education.
Sounds like something we need to be doing. Hey, Chef Shelley, we are out of time. I can't believe it.
I know. Like,
time flies when you're having fun. But let me ask you this. If people want to find your little helpful tips and things, where do they go?
You need to go to facebook.com/savoringtime.
Savoring Time, and it's T-H-Y-M-E, right?
Yes. That's exactly right.
And that's it. And become a fan.
Exactly.
And we appreciate you being on. Can we get you back on with some other tips very soon?
I would love to be back on. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate you being here today. It's Chef Shelley Maddox, Savoring Time, and we'll be back with more Grape Encounters in just a second. And we are back with more Grape Encounters. I'm your host, David Wilson. And if you've listened to this show very often, you know that one of my absolute favorite topics is to interview and talk about people who were in completely different careers and decided one day that they were so enamored with wine drinking and the winemaking profession that they were willing to just really throw in the towel with regards to what they were doing before and head to wine country and try to make a brand new life. And there's one guy that is so interesting that we were able to get on today's show. His name is Larry Schaefer. Larry, you're on the line, right?
Yes, I am.
And Larry, you were a marketing guy, right?
Yes, I was.
And had absolutely no interests. I mean, you weren't doing anything in the wine business, right?
I was not, other than enjoying wine, but not as a collector, just as a casual drinker.
And you were actually selling and marketing educational supplies and, I guess, children's pop-up books. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I had been in the publishing industry for a number of years, and I became a vice president of sales for a company that specialized in creating pop-up and novelty books for both kids and adults, actually.
Okay, but then flash forward, in just January of this year, the San Francisco Chronicle called you a winemaker to watch. How long have you actually been making wine?
Well, I graduated from UC Davis with my master's degree in viticulture and enology in 2005. And started working for Fess Parker that year. And in 2006, I decided to take the plunge and start making my own wine. So the 2009 vintage was actually my fourth vintage making wines, though I've only been selling wines for a little more than about a year and a half.
Take me back. You're marketing children's educational supplies, and all of a sudden you come home and you tell your wife, Christy it is, I think, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to make wine. Am I missing something?
It was kind of a joint decision. I had been unhappy doing what I was doing. I had achieved kind of all I wanted to do, and we both realized that, you know, life is way too short not to enjoy what you do, and I'm pretty much a full-throttle person all the time, and I wasn't being that way. And so we realized it definitely was time for a change, and my wife is actually the one who came up with the concept of me getting into wine. Like I said, I had been interested in it. I had enjoyed drinking wine, but I was more infatuated with kind of the process of how do you start with a grape and end up with a wine.
No, but that seems totally off the wall to me that you and your wife are sitting around and she says, you know what, I know what, if you want a career change, how about winemaking? I mean, why not brain surgery?
Well, it would have been wonderful to be a professional volleyball player, but I'm not quite tall enough. So, you know, it was one of those things that I think we both realized that should I be able to overcome my fear of science, which I certainly had as an undergrad, with my sales and marketing background, it would put me into a kind of a unique subset of people in our industry that have both technical skills but also have the ability and desire, more than the ability, to speak to consumers one-on-one in a language that hopefully they can understand.
So where were you living before you decided to go to UC Davis?
Down in Orange County, actually. My wife and I moved from Redondo Beach down to Orange County after we started having kids. We have three young kids now, and so we were living down there. And starting in 2001, I started taking classes in junior colleges while working part-time for a winery in Temecula. And starting in 2003, I commuted for 2 years from Orange County up to Sacramento to go to UC Davis to get my master's.
You commuted, so how often did you have to go up there?
Every week. So I would hop on a plane either at John Wayne or Ontario on either late Sunday night or early Monday morning. I'd go to class Monday through Thursday afternoon or Friday morning and then hop on a plane and come back.
Get it. So you had no social life at all?
No, I kind of look at that period of I was not a full-time student, I was not a full-time dad, I was not a full-time husband. It was a tough time, in all honesty, and it was a bit of a price to pay, but I think that the end has certainly justified the means.
Okay, so now in January, the San Francisco Chronicle calls you a winemaker to watch, and I think they're talking about your Thompson Vineyard Syrah, right?
A number of my different wines, yeah.
So how does this happen? How do you get noticed?
Well, I think I do a couple of things. One, because of my background, I don't feel there are any doors that are closed to me. Perhaps there should be, but I knock until they open. If they don't open, I kick them down. And I enjoy dealing with people, so I have a good relationship with the writers up there. I've got a good relationship with a lot of different writers and reviewers. Not that I necessarily utilize that to do anything other than to communicate with them.
Okay, so last week, the Santa Barbara Independent, one of my favorite newspapers, says that you are the self-ordained top Santa Barbara wine country promoter.
Well, I love the area that we live in. When it was time to get out of school and find a winemaking region to choose, the easiest choice would have been to stay in Napa or Sonoma. That's where most of my research was done at Davis. But I really didn't feel that it was the best place for our family as a whole to reside. And we had been up to the Santa Barbara County area a couple of times and just really fell in love with more the vibe of it than anything else, and the low-key attitude of the winemakers here. For the most part, the process is what's important, not the pomp and circumstance.
Are you amazed by how many guys like you are residing in the area that, you know threw away one career in favor of a winemaking career? There's a lot of that, right?
Well, there is, but I think that's probably true in a lot of industries. A very small subset of people will follow their passion and do something entirely different than what they had set out to do. And yeah, there certainly are quite a few people in this area that are like that. There's starting to be more people that are quote unquote more classically trained, like myself. Our head winemaker Blair Fox also graduated from Davis. Dave Potter, who you mentioned, graduated from Curtin University in Australia. So we've kind of taken a different route. There are other people like Michael Segway from Beckman and Cayena, one of my favorite guys in the valley here, who was a server at California Pizza Kitchen, and 8 years later is head winemaker at Beckman after working his tail off as a cellar rat and moving up from there. But I knew for me, going to school and getting that degree was going to expedite my path in this industry.
We're talking to Larry Schaefer, who is the owner of Tercero Wines, but also an assistant winemaker over at the Fess Parker operation. And Larry, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is blending wines. There was an article back in October in the Santa Barbara Independent that was talking about a wine called Thread, right?
Correct.
And they call it a masterpiece Syrah-Grenache blend of four individually made wines from highly regarded Santa Barbara County vineyards. And I guess there were a number of people involved in making this wine. Tell me about blending, because I think that's something that's it's becoming every year more and more popular, and the blends are actually getting more and more expensive, right?
They are, and I'm kind of a proponent of both ways. Many of my wines, if it's a varietally labeled wine, such as a Grenache or a Syrah, in my case, they're all 100%. And I really feel strongly, there's a lot of leeway that the government allows you. So if you call a wine a Syrah, you can literally put 24.9% of something else in there and legally continue to call it Syrah. And with varietals like Grenache, which is my favorite variety, it's such a pretty aromatic wine that if you add oak and you add a bunch of Syrah, it's become something that it isn't. And there's nothing wrong with that, but when it's labeled as Grenache and that's what people think it is, it changes, you know, my perspective, I guess, of that wine. When it comes to blends, I do both. I do single varietals, but then I also do blends, and then I do have this project called Thread. And it's a lot of fun. It's the ultimate goal is that the sum is greater than the parts, and if you've achieved that, then you know you can look back and piece the pieces together, I guess, and see how they all affected the final product.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever, at home, just blended wine for a meal or for an occasion, actually done that?
Sure. I mean, you can oftentimes, you know, well, we all buy wines and they don't necessarily live up to our expectations, or they might be interesting, but you might think, well, if I, you know, tried a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it's a fun experiment to do. And often,
how do you even approach blending wine?
For my labels, I approach it with a final product in mind. I know where I want to go. It's a matter of trying to get there, and it's a matter of looking at the pieces that I have to work with and trying different percentages to see how it works. And it's really trial and error.
Is it like playing the piano, let's say, by ear? I mean, do you know kind of where this thing's going to go and what you kind of need to put in there?
Sometimes. And it is like that, but more often it's not. You can have it in your mind what you're trying to achieve, and theoretically you can say, okay, well, this wine has a lot of structure but not a lot of acid. This wine has a lot of acid but not a lot of structure. Let's blend the two, and this is what we should get. And I would say that half the time it works the way you think it's going to, and half the time it doesn't.
I interviewed somebody several months ago, and we were talking about blending. And he said that even a fraction of a percent, one way or another, too much or too little, could make a huge difference. And is it really that sensitive?
It can be. I'm not going to say it is per se. I've never found it to be that big a difference, percentage here, a percentage there. I found more in the 5 to 10% range
Right. Really
affects things. But it all depends upon the varieties that you're working with and what you're trying to achieve. A lot of the wines, for instance, that I work on at Epiphany are bigger, bolder wines. And so you need to move the needle, so to speak, you need to put more in there. Because if you put just a tiny bit, it doesn't really move the needle one way or the other.
Okay, so last question. If you were stranded on a desert island and you had to drink just one varietal of wine or a blend, what would it be?
Grenache.
That's it. End all to beat all.
I believe it is. I believe it's a variety that, especially over the last 5 years and looking ahead 5 years, is going to come on very strongly in terms of being a very versatile, food-friendly variety, as offering up just an aromatic profile that cannot be matched with any other variety.
I'm not saying
it's better or worse, but in my mind, it's just very unique and very enticing and sexy.
What other varietals are we seeing coming on strong now?
Well, I think there's a movement more to Italian varietals, especially in Santa Barbara County. You're seeing more things like Vermentino, more Sangiovese, more Nebbiolo, more Spanish varieties, Albarino, Tempranillo. And these are all kind of getting little footholds, not huge amounts, but little footholds.
Okay, well, we are out of time, but if somebody wants to taste your wines or discover them, where do they go?
Well, they can email me. They can visit my website at terceirowines.com, and they could arrange to meet with me kind of on a to-be-determined basis. And I'll be doing a lot of other events, Hospice du Rhone, most likely an event called Tapas, which is a Tempranillo and Spanish varietal event up in San Francisco. So if you keep your ears and eyes open, whether on Facebook, Twitter, or somewhere on the web, you'll generally see me posting that I'm going to be somewhere.
And you need to get in there and become Larry's friend on Facebook soon, because with the limitations on the number of people that you can have as friends, you're not going to get a shot for very much longer. That's going to do it, Larry, for this segment. Hey, we really appreciate you being on. And again, you can go to terceirowines.com. That's T-E-R-C-E-R-O. And we'll be right back with more Grape Encounters. Hang in there. And we are back with the final segment of Grape Encounters Radio. David Wilson here. And earlier on, we had Chef Shelley Maddox, who, as we mentioned, has an enormous following on Facebook and the social media pages. But one of the true queens of social media is also on the line with us for the final segment. We love her. Seattle wine gal, all the way up from Seattle. Oh, there's a coincidence. Hey, welcome to the show.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
I mean, I assume that you're in Seattle. I noticed a post that the weather was lousy up there in Seattle, so but you do get around.
That would be kind of awkward if I was in New York calling myself Seattle Wine Gal. Yeah, it's authentic. I'm here in Seattle on a sunny day, mind you.
Oh, it is. So the weather's good now.
Yeah.
But you had a little weather earlier on in the week.
Yeah. Oh, well, we had the sunniest winter I think I can remember, so a little bit of rain, we're due for it, and we're all okay with it.
So, you know, I wanted to get you on the show. We had you on some weeks ago. We had a great time. But, you know, you are definitely the person that people are looking to for information, not only about, you know, great wines, but, you know, just the whole wine culture. And you really are a rule breaker. That is for sure. You're a rebel, right?
Yeah. I think I'm becoming one of the faces of the changing wine demographic and wine marketing, absolutely.
Well, I saw a picture of you. I don't know where it was. It's a picture of you actually drinking from the wine bottle, which is, you know, in most people's book, a no-no. But you seem to find that perfectly acceptable.
You tweet with the beer in the shower.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. You now have a following how big?
Cross-platform, meaning Twitter, Facebook, blog, subscribers. I have about 15,000 followers and fans.
And do these followers, do they send you questions about protocol, wine protocol and things like that? Or
Absolutely.
They just follow your lead?
You know, I have more followers down in your neck of the woods. I've got basically most of my followers are wine people. From everywhere, from Italy to Iowa.
And then it just stops in Iowa?
Yeah.
You could maybe become the Des Moines white wine gal, perhaps, as
oh,
well.
Oh, gosh.
You know, take on different... You know, because after a while, these Facebook pages fill up, and then you got to have a new identity, so you could...
nice idea.
Not bad. So I wanted to talk to you today about something that we talked about off the air, which is the... we'll call it the disconnect between the wine industry and the wine drinking public. I mean, are they on the same page, or is somebody missing something?
I think the sort of recent assumption of a disconnect has largely everything to do with the shift in wine culture to being a very young, fun, you know, wine demographic, which is,
right.
is mine. I'm 30, almost 31, and you know, I think that the winemakers and wine magazines and marketers in general are definitely missing the mark. Now, when you want to talk about a disconnect, I would say that the biggest disconnect is with small producers, and they're like artists. They're producing, and musicians are producing what tickles their fancy, you
right.
know, what plays with their palate, and that's wonderful. I commend them, and I would never want them to do otherwise. But they're not marketing like a mass-produced winery would. They've got pros doing it, and they're marketing to the new wine consumer. So,
but my question
small houses are typically not really doing that.
Yeah, but who cares? I mean, if a little guy just wants to make wine the way he wants to make it for his own palate and hopes that people will appreciate it in the same way he does, what's wrong with that?
Well, absolutely. I totally agree with you. What's wrong is when he says to me, "How come I can't get young wine drinkers to consume my wine? Nobody's buying it. They're buying screw caps and box wines and
you're making my skin crawl. Stop! Don't say the S word. Jeez. Okay,
man.
So you're not going to
have an interesting conversation.
You are not going to tell me that screw caps and boxed wines are acceptable, are you? Are you? Is that what you're going to do?
You know, I drink very high quality wine. I have a really great wine budget and definitely know my stuff and would challenge anybody who's skin would crawl from box wine and screw cap. Basically, I'm not challenging you, but what are the, I mean, you look at the pros and the cons of box wines and screw caps. You know, the only con I can come up with is that it's not romantic, it's not appealing. The pros are numerous, everything from environmental superiority, preservation, it minimizes flaws, it's more accessible in a box and a screw cap. So if you can come up with any other reason other than it just kind of itches you out,
well, that's a pretty big reason, if you ask me, that it's not as romantic. That's like saying the only reason for not eating, you know, frozen food is that it doesn't taste good. I mean, it seems to me that that romance is about 75% of what wine is all about. Maybe it's 90%. Yeah. I mean, if you've ever, anybody that's ever had a dinner date over that has unscrewed the top and it makes that crunching sound, you know, that kind of a sound. That,
I don't mind it. Well, I mean, I definitely understand that, and but the thing that I'm, you know, trying to advocate for is the new wine consumer, and if winemakers and houses don't want to lose our demographic, then they really do have to shift, because we're not a very practical demographic, but when it comes to wine drinking, we definitely are. So it's certainly, and so if you open a Wine Spectator, I mean, I don't know too many people my age who read it unless they just want it on their coffee table to look good. That marketing is not towards to me, not at all. It's to you, and right. And that's a problem. And so the wineries are still doing that. You open it up and you've got luxury car ads, and I mean, you know. And so that's the way wine marketing is right now. And it's just the people who are shifting that are making out like bandits, and I'm watching it happen.
If you're just joining us, we've got the Seattle Wine Gal on the line. She is the all-seeing, all-knowing sage of the wine business, especially for younger people. And you're kind of the princess of Pinot, the queen of Cabernet, the maven of Merlot, all things to all wine drinkers, I suppose. But you have a very different perspective, got to tell you. So you would not object to buying a boxed wine and serving it at a Seattle Wine Gal dinner party?
Well, I would, because unfortunately, like archaic marketing, nobody is producing a higher-end boxed wine. It's the pickings are pretty slim, and it's shocking to me.
Why is that?
And whoever grabs that idea and runs with it is going to make a lot of money. Maybe I should. Maybe I shouldn't go on air with this.
Why are they going to make a lot of money with that?
Because you know, somebody like me, and who, you know, is wine savvy and definitely has the consumer power, is looking for something more accessible and looking for something more environmentally friendly. I mean, it's 9 times more environmentally friendly to produce a boxed wine than it is a bottled wine with a cork.
Okay,
and
I don't know. I hate to interrupt, but I don't understand that. Okay, you can recycle the bottle, mm-hmm. and the cork is why is that why is that environmentally unfriendly? It's just
a
natural product.
They don't really recycle the bottle. They recycle about 10 to 20% of it, depending on the state that you live in. And, you know, the cork supply is depleting and causing all sorts of international issues. And it's just, it's definitely environmentally unfriendly. And if you look at a boxed wine, that's 4 bottles of wine in that box, taking up, you know, a tenth of, you know, the waste of what you'd create if you opened 4 bottles.
And
so that is a major concern for a wine drinker of my demographic.
And does the wine just keep better in the box for a longer period of time?
Oh, you can have it for 30 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so it doesn't spoil nearly as much because the air is not getting back in the box, right? The little bag inside is contracting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a phenomenal science behind it. Now that was totally ruined sometime in the 70s when, you know, the Franzia and the box wines. I'm not knocking those either, but it definitely, you think white Zinfandel and you think box wine, which is such a shame.
Okay, you know what? That we have to end it with that, because when you say white Zinfandel, that's the end of the show.
Did I win the debate?
Well, I'm not sure. We're going to have to pick it up another time, but I certainly would be interested to find out if anybody out there is making a good boxed wine, and that's going to be, I think, our mission is to see if we can actually find that, and we'll taste it on the show and
awesome.
see what gives there. But you know what? That's going to do it for now. If you want to know more about Seattle Wine Gal, or you just want her insights, she's got a great blog. Tell them where to go.
www.seattlewinegal.com, and I'm at Seattle Wine Gal on Twitter and Seattle Wine Gal on Facebook.
Oh, and by the way, her blog on tasting room etiquette is absolutely fall down on your face screaming funny, and you got to check that out. So if for nothing else, go and check out that blog. It is absolutely hysterical. I want to rip it off and take credit for it myself, but anyway, hey, that's it. So we'll talk to you next time. Okay, that's it for Grape Encounters Radio. It's David Wilson. We'll see you next week at the same time. Thanks for joining us.